Welcome to Community Conversations. These are pre-recorded interviews brought to you each Tuesday and Thursday at 8 a.m. on KRFY. Because of ongoing concerns about the COVID pandemic, we are not able to be in the studio doing live broadcast interviews right now. But we are still dedicated to recording and bringing to you topics of local and current interest, highlighting voices from our community. For Community Conversations, we are using phones and web-based technology so that participants can be recorded remotely. Please bear with us if there are any gaps or hiccups that might be caused by a slow or unstable phone or internet connection. Also, keep in mind that because these interviews are recorded, information may change between the time of this recording and the time that you hear it broadcast. Thank you for joining us for today's Community Conversation on KRFY 88.5 FM, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho. Good morning and welcome to another edition of Community Conversations. This one, our first in May. And Julie, my co-host and I have taken a tradition of the last couple years focusing on mental health issues because May is Mental Health Month. Good morning,
yes,
Julie.
Yes, we have. Good morning, Phil. And it's great to see your shining face and at least one of our other guests. What's happening in your world as spring springs into action, Phil?
Well, a whole lot of things are happening. I got out on a short little hike yesterday to introduce someone to the pleasures of the Scotchman Peaks, and the wildflowers are out, and the rubber boas were coming out because it was 75 degrees. So snakes and wildflowers, what could be better? What could be wilder?
I know it. And beyond that, I saw a skink last week at Farragut, which was very exciting for me. And I'm starting to plant my garden. So spring is springing, Phil.
Yeah, the yard work beckons. We are pre-recording this, so I'll say this weekend, last weekend, for when you hear this. May is also a time when the first week of May is usually devoted to Idaho Gives. And that's currently in progress. So you've got a couple more days if you're listening to go out and support your favorite nonprofit charity. There's quite a few in our area that are signed up on Idaho Gives. If you go to that and do the search, you can find them. But if you're a member of any of those organizations, undoubtedly you already know that it's Idaho Gives Week.
That's right.
And if you want to support your local radio station, Community Radio KRFY, we will be having a pledge drive coming up at the end of the month. And we'll hear more details as we get towards the end of May, 1st of June on that, Julie.
Yes, well, there will be more about the upcoming membership drive soon. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce our topic.
I do want to say the other thing May brings is our cat Oreo's annual visit to the vet. And so he's looking forward to that. And I do want to apologize for our guests and all of their colleagues in advance for his annual visit to the vet. He can be a right cantankerous cat. And I've been thinking about that, you know, especially those vets who deal with cats. I'm guessing a lot of the cats are right cantankerous.
I should think so. So I'm going to go ahead and introduce our topic and our guests. And Phil's already mentioned that it is Mental Health Month coming, the month of May. And because of that, we've invited two veterinarians to join us today to talk about an organization, NOMV, Not One More Vet, Veterinarian. And it's about veterinarians and the amazingly high rate of suicide among them. Our guests this morning are Dr. Celeste Grace. Good morning, Dr. Grace.
Good morning.
So good to have you. And our second guest is Dr. Laura Talega. And Dr. Laura is from the Northeast Washington Spay Neuter Alliance. Good morning, Dr. Laura.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yes, it's great to have you both. Well, as usual, we'll ask you to start by telling us a bit about your backgrounds and experiences as veterinarians. And let's start with you, Dr. Laura.
Yes, good morning. So I grew up in Pennsylvania, not a local. I've lived out here for almost 10 years, though. Went to vet school, actually, in the Caribbean, so not WSU. Fantastic school, though. And for me personally, I knew I always wanted to be a shelter veterinarian, which is actually a specialty. I work with pet overpopulation, do a lot of spay neuter, a lot of herd health, So private practice, which is what most listeners are involved with, I do some relief work with that. But the major stuff I do is actually a lot of surgery and a lot of helping low-income and no-income folks with their animals. And that's what I've been doing in the Pacific Northwest for almost 10 years now. And started my own business, which is the Northeast Washington Spay-Neuter Alliance. I've got a 20-foot surgery trailer and a one-ton dually from 1986. And we do travel around and try to reach those places that need some cheaper services for basic stuff for their animals. And that's what I do.
Very good. And I guess you're going to have something in common with Dr. Grace then, because I believe she's a mobile veterinarian too. Dr. Grace, tell us about a bit about your background and how you came to be here in Sandpoint.
Thank you. So I, like Dr. Laura, I'm not from the area. I'm an East Coast gal, although I was born in Colorado, but grew up in the East. And I actually graduated from Cornell 31 years ago. So I've been doing this for a long time and moved out to Sandpoint about 10 years ago for family reasons, and then just set up shop here, running my own business that now has become a partnership, and third veterinarian joined us. So we're a group of three women. And for most of my life, I just did horses. I was specifically trained in some equine surgery and just did horses. And when I moved here, it became apparent that there was a great need for large animal livestock veterinarians in general. So with the help of my business partner, Dr. Jenny Grimmett, I have branched out to do a lot of animals besides horses, but my specialty still is horses. And we do drive around. We put a lot of miles on the trucks. We go from north of Bonners to sometimes Libby, Montana, south of Coeur d'Alene, into Washington, and every place in between. So we spend a lot of time in the truck, but I don't take a trailer behind me, so I have it easier than Dr. Laura.
We appreciate the time both of you are spending today, and I understand from past conversations with Dr. Grace, this is still in the middle or maybe coming towards the end of the spring birthing season, a particularly busy time.
It's the middle of it, and in fact, one of our vets right now is in the midst of potentially having to deliver a baby alpaca, so it's it ends sometime in June.
And I think this highlights something that a lot of us really don't have a great, us laymen have a great understanding of the profession that you're in. And I was very intrigued a month or so back when Dr. Laura had on her Facebook page a frame around her picture saying, "Not one more vet." I was thinking, well, what does that mean? And I don't want to spill the beans on that. I'd like one of you maybe to tell us what the "not one more vet" means. Maybe Dr. Laura, you would like to field that.
Sure, 100%. So not one more vet is all it really is a movement that's a nonprofit that provides support. And where it came from was back in 2014, after a colleague that I think this was early in my career. I graduated in 2012. Being in shelter medicine, I also loved behavior. And there was a woman, Dr. Sophia Yin, that was just, she was a legend. She was, she did so many, listen to me, I'm choking up here. She did so many talks across the country. Her energy, she was a dynamo. And she really was revolutionizing the behavioral aspect of dogs and cats, mostly dogs, in our society and how they relate to our humans. Veterinary medicine is, of course, very medical, and behavior is something that is really missed. It's not something we address often, but yet, of course, everybody comes to us for it. And also in the vet clinic, everybody, you know, just because we work with dogs and cats all day long, we have a lot of awareness about behavior, et cetera. But to really change that dynamic into a forward thinking positive, 100% positive, and understanding these animals for what they are. And Sophia Yen, her work was just legendary, and she committed suicide. And it just took the rug out from everyone. She was definitely one of those humans that was the most positive, energetic, helpful human ever. And you'd never, ever think. And so Dr. Nicole MacArthur, in October 2014, started this movement, Not One More Vet. And I think it goes along with a lot of the other things that are happening in our society with, you know, Black Lives Matter, is it's a conversation, and it normalizes things. It makes people aware, because if we don't talk about it, how is anyone supposed to know? There's so many factors involved in mental health. And in fact, the elevated suicide rate for veterinarians is not actually a new thing in particular. It is something that has been around, and it's not unique to the U.S., by the way. It is all across the world. I think Australia is kind of a country, I don't know, for me, I think, okay, Australia, they're great, right? They have the same problem, and they have for years. And suicide is up about 30% everywhere. But unfortunately, that also includes veterinarians. Veterinarians as a whole are about 4 times more likely than the average human. And that's a pretty scary figure. There's a lot of other professions as well. But when you look at the kind of graduate school professions, so doctors, dentists, lawyers, things like that, we're twice as likely as dentists, twice as likely as your human medical field. And these are, of course, just broad sweeping generalizations. But that's where this is coming from. And I'm definitely one of those people that I like talking about uncomfortable things, because if folks don't know about it, and that's everywhere, that's the people working in the clinic and also the clients going to the clinic. If people don't know about it, how the heck are they supposed to be able to understand the whole thing of what's going on? So that's where it came from.
Yeah. And I'm just going to add another statistic as you continue on, Dr. Laura. I understand that the rate of female veterinarian suicide is much higher even than the general rate. So women in veterinary medicine have an even bigger challenge.
So,
yep, absolutely.
I know when I first saw this and read this, I was surprised. And I've talked to a few of my laypeople colleagues, and they were surprised. And I think it's because we all know we have particularly sisters or friends growing up who want to be a vet. And it's a profession that has a certain attraction. And we also know how competitive it is. But because of that attraction, we don't think that there's necessarily a problem. So Dr. Grace, maybe you want to chime in here. Why is the suicide rate in the veterinary profession so high?
Well, I think it's multifactorial, but I think personally, I think part of it starts from the way that we have been admitting people to veterinary school for a long time. I mean, since before I went, which, as everybody will tell you, they can say, oh, it's easier to get into human medical school than it is to get into veterinary school. And for some reason, at some point, it went from being a profession where you'd have, you know, agriculture, farm kids, country kids, you know, getting in there because they're practical and they want to go back to the farms and work. And it transitioned from that admission to suddenly being incredibly competitive academically. So if you botched one class undergrad, there went your chances potentially for getting into veterinary school. And I think it's a little bit crazy, because you don't have to be a rocket scientist to practice veterinary medicine. In fact, it takes a lot more than just brains to be a great veterinarian. But we are selecting for type A competitive people that maybe can't take failure as easily as others. So I think we're starting off by having a very competitive class of professionals. And then the hours that we work are incredibly exhausting, especially I would argue large animal, because we don't have the option to send animals to emergency clinics, which has been a thing the past 10 years. The debt that students have when they come out of practice is mind-blowing. I mean, out of school is mind-blowing. There's some that have $350,000 worth of student loans. And, you know, when I'm looking to hire somebody, we can't pay somebody enough to be able to have them pay off that kind of a debt. And then on that same note, the salaries that you get paid are nowhere near that what is commensurate with our education. If you take a look at other people that go to 4 years graduate school. So I think those things certainly set us up for stress and the potential for mental illness that maybe isn't addressed. And I think they're doing a better job of it now in veterinary school, but certainly when I went, they did not. Nobody addresses mental health, anxiety, depression, addiction, and avenues to get help. I think it was more of a, you're supposed to suck it up and not let anybody know that you're having trouble.
So I think there's a couple good follow-up questions here. I know Julie has one or two, and I'm thinking, chime in here, but I've been thinking about what the reasons might be. And it occurs to me that most practices, you're going to have really two sets of clients. You've got the animals, of course, that you're working on, and then you've got their owners or their human companions. And so different than a regular doctor, or maybe just a shade different, you've really got those two competing pressures. Is that part of the problem, at least sometimes?
I think for sure. And we address this with pre-vet students all the time. When somebody says, I want to go into veterinary medicine because I love animals and I really don't like people, probably it's not a career for you, because we have to deal with people. And in high stress, high emotional situations, where I guess one other thing to add to the to things that affect our mental health is we are having to, sometimes for good reasons, euthanize animals. And that can take a toll. Having to deal with an owner, I shouldn't say having to deal with that, that didn't sound right. But interacting with an owner and a pet in these highly emotional situations can really take a toll. And you know, the animals don't like what we're doing necessarily, but they don't talk back to us, but the owners can be pretty harsh sometimes, and they're stressed, and sometimes they're not very nice to us, understandably.
Yeah, and I'll just jump in and mention that I've thought about it too. And, you know, of course we don't euthanize people. We do euthanize pets, and just the way we view them as patients, the owners, some owners, it's like they would be as though they were their children, and other people don't feel the same way. And so that I would think would be very stressful for you as veterinarians.
For sure.
Yeah.
Definitely jumping off of that, finances. You know, we go to school and we learn a lot of things about saving animals, and somehow finances becomes a really, really big stressor. So in the middle of a stressful emotional situation, whether it's an emergency or something perfectly preventable, or just an accident, life happens. The veterinarian in a human doctor office, you know, you don't get to negotiate prices. There's a lot of different people there involved in what's going on. But in the vet profession, we kind of do it all. We are responsible for the business aspect. We're responsible for employing everyone and getting paychecks out. And somehow when there's this animal that needs help and the owner can't afford the help, they look at lashing out at someone, and that's the doctor. And we get kind of nailed for that a lot, and it hurts so much, because that's all we ever want to do is to help. We're perfectionists. We want to fix everything that ever comes across our way. And sometimes we can't because that's reality. And that's very difficult. But sometimes we can, but they can't afford it. And that is the most heart-wrenching scenario that I find myself in, which is,
I think that's a nice segue into the next question, which is really with both of you. And we want to thank you for your service to these rural communities where often the financial strain does come into play. You're serving populations that are not as wealthy. And as comfortable as each of you are, it would be interesting, I think, to our listeners to put the very human face on this and for you to talk about the stress of your particular situation and how you cope with it. And so Dr. Grace, we'll put you on the spot first.
So as I said, I've been doing this for over 30 years, and I figured out from the beginning, and a lot of it came from hints from older practitioners or friends about how to keep yourself happy. So one thing for sure is I try to have some balance outside of my job as much as I possibly can. And, you know, luckily for me, I live now in North Idaho. I've always lived in rural places. So getting outside for me is therapeutic. Taking a run, I'm an avid runner, biker, and I've always said all I need is 10 minutes. If I can just get 10 minutes of running in the morning, taking my dogs out, that does amazing things to my mind and my body. And then I feel like I can deal with anything for the rest of the day. Another thing somebody told me once, and I think it was my first boss back in New York, Dr. Bill Bradley. And, you know, before social media and email, we would get letters sometimes, and sometimes just phone calls, but letters of, effusive praise and thank you and heartfelt words. And then you'd also occasionally get a letter from somebody, either because you made a mistake or because they thought you made a mistake or they just didn't like the way that you looked at them or something. So somebody told me, my boss told me, you're going to remember the hate letters far more than you remember the kind letters. So every time you get a letter from a client, put it in a file. And when you get a dissatisfied letter, which honestly doesn't happen very often, but when it does, it affects you so much. So when you get one of those letters, read it, you know, make sure that you pay attention to why they read it, and then put it aside and go to your file and just pull out these letters from clients that have gone above and beyond. And that, I still have that. I mean, here in my office, I have a folder with those letters, or I save the emails, because that is just a simple thing that can raise your mental attitude, I think. And then trying to keep humor. And I think part of that also is making sure you surround yourself with the people that are going to help you with that. So I spend hours with my technician in my truck, and it was just by chance that we found each other when she moved here a year after I did. And she's, you know, smart and hardworking and just couldn't be a better technician. But the sense of humor she has also helps, because sometimes laughter is the best medicine. And if you get to the point where you can't sit back and look at a situation and actually, you know, kind of chuckle about it, and I'm not saying in serious situations, but, you know, cows that run away, that kind of stuff. I think that also helps yes. me.
So. And I believe Phil and I have both met your assistant, Susie, and she is a funny one. I can't imagine anyone more fun to work with.
Yep. Yes.
Yep. Yes.
So that's mine. So Dr. Laura.
100%. Those are some good ones. I'm right there with you, sweetie. I have been so lucky in my life, just between, you know, my parents as examples of how to work hard and play hard, And I have a couple of veterinary mentors, even from before vet school. Dr. Hank Nebzadovsky, what a guy. Just an old school gruff farm vet who did some small animal too. But he was definitely a large animal guy doing small animal. And, you know, no one's perfect, but that when I was a little sponge, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old, he was definitely someone who kind of spoke to my heart. And humor, 100% every day. If you can't laugh at whatever's going on and you can't laugh at yourself, I don't know. I don't know what I'd do if I couldn't laugh. You're absolutely right. Keeping that perspective. We're so self-critical and we're such perfectionists that we can't successfully communicate all the time. You know, if something doesn't go right, if something goes wrong, trying to communicate that there are things beyond my control. This is not a computer program here. This is medicine. It's called practice for a reason. Then there's no crystal ball, and trying to communicate that to the owners is a huge challenge. I mean, you got to be a therapist sometimes, and nobody teaches you how to do that. And having that, I think that's we're having that empathy. You know, if someone is lashing out, just not taking it personal. They're lashing out because they're stressed, they're emotional. And maybe, yeah, I wasn't able to do a good enough job to communicate the situation. And I'm sorry that, you know, I did the best I could. But really, you know, keeping that kind of out at arm's length and going, yes, that is normal. You know, being upset is normal. It's okay. Even though you think it's my fault, I know, you know, I did the best and I'm human too. You know, we all, again, make mistakes, and to be, you know, completely strung up for something is a little, you know, as long as we learn from that and move forward and don't dwell in it, that's called life in every aspect. We just deal with life and death on a daily basis.
So you both, one of the things I think that's very intriguing, and I'd be curious to get your take on how widespread this is in your profession, but you both volunteer using your professional services. And I'd like to hear more about how that helps maybe you cope, but also maybe creates some stress. And Dr. Grace, do you want to start? And if we have time later, we can delve more into the details of those volunteer services, but for now, the general impact.
Yeah, so my volunteer is with Project Samana, which is a not-for-profit that runs an operation down in the Dominican Republic. So I go down there one week a year. And for me, it does add a little bit of stress just because of the logistics of trying to prepare for practice down in one of the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere. But what it does do is it gets completely away from some of the mundane stuff that we have to deal with every day here, which is paperwork and computer work and recording. And we have, because we don't have an office person, I mean, the phone calls and the text messages that we receive every day, which is great. They're wonderful clients, you know, it's business, I love it. But having to deal with that on top of trying to keep a very busy schedule and, you know, practice medicine, that's exhausting. And you go down to the Dominican Republic, there is none of that. So you're away from all of that. You're experiencing completely different quality of being able to care for animals. These animals are their livelihoods, and super appreciative people, understandably, because it's, you know, we're coming down there and providing free services, and it's just a different take on veterinary medicine that still allows us to practice, but and do a really good thing, but just in not with the stresses that happen with modern technology here.
Oh, makes sense. And Dr. Laura, tell us about your volunteer work.
Yes. So certainly, being trained as a high volume spay neuter veterinarian, there's not many of us. Thankfully, there's more and more in the area, and it's a it's actually a pretty unique skill, and it's so needed across the globe, basically. Anywhere with overpopulation needs spay-neuter. And the difference between being able to do 30 to 40 cats a day versus a kind of a normal small animal clinic does a kind of a handful of surgeries in the morning, and that's about it. I was trained out at Humane Alliance, which is basically gold standard for high volume surgery over in Asheville, North Carolina. So anyone interested, go over there and learn. It actually is some different techniques. In my life, let's see, I've been out 9, almost 10 years now. Any chance I get to do spay-neuter, I do it. I'm volunteering down in Nevis. So I went to vet school in St. Kitts, actually, and Nevis is the island right next door. And any chance I head down there on vacation, of course, going to the beach, after my plane ticket, I give them a call and to give them a date, and they set up a whole day of surgeries and get some students over there. And it is stressful because you don't necessarily have all the resources you're kind of used to. But boy, is it fun. Last time I was down there, I had a 1-day-old puppy that needed an amputation. And the poor little thing coded right in front of me, and we actually got it back. It's completely normal. And the vet student just looks at me and says, "How do you not freak out?" oh my gosh, this bird was amazing. certainly volunteering is stressful, but it's great. You don't have the paperwork. You have nothing but happy people, appreciative for what you're doing. And then of course the pets, ta-da, all the animals, whether they're pets or livelihood, food animals, they're healthy and they're happy. And it's fantastic. It's a great opportunity. I think more people should do it if they can.
So for both of you, given all of your experience and everything we've talked about, if you could go back in time, would you become a vet again? Would you do it all over? Or what would you do differently? Dr. Grace, maybe start us off.
Okay, because I've been doing it for so long. Well, in hindsight, if I could do it all over again, I think that I would probably first do a career at Cirque du Soleil, because that always was on my radar, but I'm too old for that now. But I would definitely go back and do this again.
So would you be the flying trapeze artist, or would you be taking care of the circus animals?
No. I would be participating, wearing all the fun acrobatics, but you reach a certain point in your life where that just, it's impossible. So I've come to that conclusion that it's never going to happen. So I definitely would go back and do it again. I mean, I keep a journal in my truck about just the various stories that we encounter, the cases that we encounter, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And periodically, Susie and I will go back through and read it. And there's bad days. There's definitely bad days, and they are outnumbered by far by the good days. And I think, just going back to what we talked about before about how we cope, I think that has made it possible for me to do this for 31 years. It's not that common, I hate to say it, for women to stay in large animal or equine practice. A lot of times we've trained a lot of young women over the years. We had an internship at the practice I was in New York. And very often families end up becoming a priority, and families and large animal equine practice, especially if you're solo or even just two of you, it's difficult to balance those. So the fact that I'm still doing this 30 plus years, I haven't been mortally wounded and I can, I still can laugh about things. I think says that, yeah, I would do it again. And I guess the one thing I would add to what other devices we have to keep things in perspective, I think your tribe of people, your friends, your spouses, your partners are incredibly important. It's a way that you can go and release your tensions, sort of like the Not One More Vet Facebook page that's out there. That's a way for people that need to just vent sometimes, to be able to do it privately. And I think to be able to have a friend, a group of friends, a partner is immensely helpful and supportive.
Yeah, well said. And Dr. Laura, anything you might add?
Yeah, 100%. I actually almost failed out of vet school. And my dad, he just looked at me and he said, well, don't worry, you can just start over at another school and transfer your credits. It'll be fine. And that made me more scared at the time, because vet school was so hard. It was just the hardest thing I had ever done in my entire life. And all I wanted it to be was over. Now that I'm through vet school, I definitely have my dream job. Had I failed out, I'd just be happy training dogs for the rest of my life, working in a shelter, scooping poop and who knows what. But now that I am a doctor, I really do have my dream job. And I think, you know, the fact that I have a 20-foot trailer and I drive around and I wrap my own packs. I have a neighbor gal who cleans the trailer for me. It's very, I don't know what the word I'm looking for, but I do a lot of my own work. It's not a normal scenario, but it's me. It's more me than any other place I've been so far. And it took me a little while to find it. But here I am, and I can't even imagine in the future, in another 20 years, doing anything else.
Yeah, that sounds,
to be totally honest. I don't know what that would look like if I didn't have my trailer and I couldn't do surgery.
Yeah.
And so maybe that's going to be my next problem is, you know, what do I do after? Because that's another critical moment. Even right here in Spokane, the owner of Indian Trail committed suicide just a couple of years ago. You know, and he was looking at retiring. I mean, he had made it, you know, he had from the outside. He wasn't a personal friend, but boy, it's not a big community.
Yeah, a sad story. So it sounds, what I'm hearing both of you say is that it's helped that you've tailored your own careers and that's made your profession more satisfying. And the other thing that I heard earlier is that it does sound like the professional practice model is somewhat problematic, right? It's just not suited for veterinarians, maybe in the same way that it is for other health professionals. That maybe would be a topic for another time. I'd like to circle back to the organization as our time does start to draw to an end, and have each of you, if you can, tell us about your involvement in NOMV, No More, Not One More Vet, or maybe about the resources that they can offer to vets who are possibly in crisis. Dr. Grace?
Sure. Go ahead.
So I am minimally involved. I mean, I was, when it came out as it is a private Facebook group and we were all encouraged to join. I mean, I've been touched personally by a very close friend who shockingly committed suicide. So I thought it was important to at least be part of it. I know that it's resources if anybody needs it. I know that it's a great place for camaraderie. If you ever go on there, you've got, and somebody just says, I've had a terrible day. You can look and there's 300 comments for the person, you know, trying to support them. That's about the extent that I am involved, but knowing that it's there and knowing that if I were to have a friend or if I ever needed anything, you can go directly to Not One More Vet and get to the resources that we need.
Anything to add, Dr. Laura, about the NOMV?
No, 100%. Facebook has over 26,000 members in the conversation. And to put that into perspective, there's only 120,000 vets in the US. So I think that's incredible. Even though it was started back in 2014, it kind of trickled a little bit, but it's really kind of exploded recently. And just like anything with, I mean, mental health, yes, any issue, knowing you're not alone. A lot of vets practice alone, you know, one or two, maybe three vets in an office and that's it. How many social scenarios do we have where someone else really understands where we're coming from? Very few. And just understanding that you're not alone and that there are resources is the biggest first step that I can think of. So same here, really just a support and conversation. And thank you so much for having us, because this is part of it right here. And I think there was another resource that I think is also local. There was a TED Talk not long ago by Dr. Melanie Bowden, B-O-W-D-E-N, Coeur d'Alene TED Talk about what being a veterinarian really takes. And that is something that I think everyone who is, you know, interested in what we're talking about right now, just spending 2 seconds thinking about this, check that out. She did a beautiful job. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
I think all of our listeners, probably because we live in small communities, either know a vet or we have pets or farm animals and we know a vet one way or the other, socially or professionally. And so this would be a reminder or an encouragement to be kind to your vet, reach out to them, support them. And beyond that tropism, what can individuals do to help? What resources can our listeners help with, even if it's just becoming more educated about the subject matter? Maybe Dr. Grace, we'll start with you on that.
I think exposure and education about the subject matter is probably utmost important. I think we are sometimes ridiculously put on pedestals, and I think that should not happen, whether it's by, you know, the kids in the family or the parents. We all make mistakes. We all have good days and bad days. And I think we're human. People need to remember that. And I guess I would just say, with the day that I had yesterday, which is a day that I had a packed full day of schedules calls, and I probably got 1.5 of them done because of all the emergencies. And hands down, with the exception of one client, I just put out calls and said, I don't know whether we're going to get to you today. And everybody is so understanding. And I think that's part of it is, you know, trying to figure out what we're doing on a day-to-day basis and say, yeah, this is no problem. We'll see you tomorrow. We'll see you next week. It's okay. You know, flexibility and understanding.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I hear you saying that. And I think that's important in all areas of life, especially during COVID. We're not all James Harriet. This is not all Creatures Great and Small, is it?
Sometimes
it is. And then I'll just add for resources or something that might further listeners' understanding about this issue and your issues as veterinarians. There's a great Time Magazine article from September 2019. If you're Googling NAMVI, you might go there too, or the TED Talk. I found it to be very illuminating.
So we're coming to the end of the show or close to it. Dr. Laura, more closing thoughts or suggestions on other resources for individuals who would like to help or learn more?
Gosh, I think you guys nailed it. Just be nice, everyone. We're all in this together.
Now that is wholly good advice in all situations. Dr. Grace will give you the final word as the older retiring vet.
Don't forget to laugh. We are doing this because we love it, and we want to continue to do it because we love it. So,
there you have it.
Thank you for doing this.
Good advice. Thank you both for coming on the show. I think that our listeners will be really appreciative, and they will learn a lot and hopefully come away with a new and profound sense and understanding and empathy. So we'd like to thank again Dr. Laura Talega from the Northeast Washington Spay and Neuter Alliance and Dr. Celeste Grace from the Sandpoint Area Veterinary Emergency. We've been talking this morning about the Not One More Veterinarian movement to address the question and issues of the high suicide rate in the profession. And we appreciate your insights. If you've just tuned in and like to hear the entire show, it will be available as a podcast on krfy.org. And of course, Julie and I hope you join us every Tuesday morning at 8 a.m. for the live show on 88.5 FM, Community Conversations, or the live stream at krfy.org. We'll be back next Tuesday. Thank you all for listening.